And this is KPCW. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's 8:06 on this Tuesday, March 18th. Currently, we've got 24 degrees and some light snow showers here in Old Town Park City, 30 degrees in the Heber Valley. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. And, you know, just like that, yesterday we went from more spring-like weather to wintertime again as we woke up this morning as a cold front made its way on through. The strong front dropping those temperatures behind the front about 10 to 20 degrees across most of the Beehive State. Now, we saw that rain change over to snow pretty quickly after midnight last night. We've had off and on snow and snow showers throughout the morning time hours. We'll see those snow showers continuing through at least the early afternoon. We may see a little bit of a lull by late afternoon, but then in the evening hours, we may see a little bit more redevelopment, especially with some lake enhancement. So I wouldn't completely say the snow will be done until later on tonight, but we'll start to see it becoming a little more scattered as we go throughout the rest of today. High temperatures around Park City only climbing to around 30 degrees this afternoon. Meanwhile, in the Heber Valley, we should climb into the mid to upper 30s across the area. Still, these temperatures, of course, are well below average for this time of the year. Now, so get ready to head into our Wednesday. Get ready for a frigid start out there across the area. Temperatures will be starting off into the mid-teens there in Park City with mid to upper teens for the Heber Valley. As we go throughout the afternoon, though, we should see lots of sunshine and those temperatures climbing back into the mid-30s for Park City. And we should top out right around the low 40s as you get into the Heber Valley. As we get into your Thursday, we'll see a quick-moving storm system moving by. That could give us a chance of a few scattered snow showers, but this system will not have nearly enough moisture to work with, kind of like the past couple of systems. So we're just talking about some very light accumulations, if any, as this thing makes its way on through. Again, that's going to be for your Thursday afternoon and the Thursday evening. By Friday, it's out of here. We're waking up to another frigid start to the day with temperatures down into the teens, but we do warm into the upper 30s in Park City for daytime highs, and highs will climb into the mid-40s around the Heber Valley. Can't rule out an isolated snow flurry or two on Friday, but for the most part, we should be dry. Our next quick-moving system will move into the area as we get into your weekend, Saturday specifically, and again, right now, it looks like it's going to be a somewhat minor system, so a chance of some scattered snow showers both in Park City and the Heber Valley, but again, we're not looking at a lot of moisture, so this will not be a significant event, but add a few more mood flakes to folks if they're going to be up and about, looking around the mountains as we go throughout this weekend. And then after that, heading into next week, looks like we start to get a nice little taste of spring as a high-pressure ridge builds in, and that's going to mean warming temperatures as we start to dry things out across the region here in the West Coast. But it has been an active storm cycle, and of course, that continues this morning. So watch out for some slick conditions on those elevated passes and elevated sidewalks, things like that, where we tend to trap some of that cold air and can make for a little bit of a light freeze this morning. But the main roadways, for the most part, are just wet at this time, which is some great news. And hopefully we see that trend continuing throughout the rest of the day. Leslie?
Okay, thanks, Edwin.
No, thank you.
And taking a look in the backcountry on the phone with us from the Utah Avalanche Center, we have Drew. Good morning, Drew.
Morning, Leslie. Danger is going to rise to considerable today on all steep, wind-drifted slopes. You know, the southerly winds have been drifting and blowing snow for days and days and days. And while most of those have stabilized with time and warmth, not all of them have, particularly at the highest elevations. And then certainly on top of that, we have this morning's storm. We should see snowfall for most of the day. The fly in the ointment, Leslie, for my take, is that the winds are going to increase out of the northwest, and we're going to see an additional batch of wind slabs on all sort of steep lee terrain. So I think if you're in the backcountry, just you want to avoid the steep wind-drifted slopes. Considerable means that human-driven avalanches are likely. And I would say that during periods of peak instability, where you're seeing 1 and 2 inches of snow per hour, naturals may occur as well. So for many people, they think it's cooler season in the Wasatch in the spring, but today is not the day to be booting up the steep couloirs across the range right now. I think you'll get avalanched with naturals running from above. So again, I would say keep it tight, keep your slope angles down today, let things settle out, and then it should just be awesome skiing and riding tomorrow with probably more of a moderate danger. But stay tuned, we'll see. You can get this information on the web at UtahAvalancheCenter.org.
Okay, Drew, thanks so much.
Thanks, Leslie.
Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour, I'll be checking in with Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybaugh in a few minutes. He'll have a preview of this week's county council meeting. Later on, Park City Mountain Ski Patroller Andy Sisbach has details on this year's backcountry bow wow. And from Park City Ski and Snowboard, Alpine Program Director Tommy Eckfeldt talking about athletes training at the UOP there on the West Peak expansion before they head up to the World Cup finals. Taking a look at some local news now, members of the Park City Council do not favor High Valley Transit's plan to widen State Route 224 by 10 feet for new dedicated bus lanes. KPCW's Parker Malatesta reports both parties will meet with state transportation officials this week.
High Valley Transit, Summit County's transportation agency, is moving forward with a multi-million dollar project to expand State Route 224 by 10 feet to create new shoulder lanes exclusively for public transit. High Valley Transit Chief Development Officer Gabe Shields previously said the new lanes will allow buses to travel between Kimball Junction and Old Town Park City in a little over 15 minutes. The Park City Council got an update on the project in late February when a majority of council members expressed opposition to High Valley's plans to widen lanes within city limits, which start at the McPullen Barn. SR 224 traffic data does show that the most significant congestion occurs between Canyons Village and Kimball Junction outside of Park City. High Valley Transit did not participate in the meeting with Park City leaders, but after their discussion, Summit County Council Vice Chair Canis Hart spoke optimistically about finalizing a plan that works for all parties. High Valley Transit Executive Director Caroline Rodriguez published a guest column in the Park Record on March 12th about the bus rapid transit project and referenced the council's concerns. Rodriguez wrote, quote, undermining key elements of the plan would compromise its effectiveness. She declined to be interviewed for this story. Several Park City Council members commented on the column Thursday. Council member Bill Sirocco said his jaw dropped when he first read it.
I couldn't understand how that could get printed when we just had the meeting that we had where we were all seemed to be aligned. It was particularly disheartening, and I'm hoping that the issue can be resolved. I'm hoping that we can move forward.
Councilmember Jeremy Rubel said he was also caught off guard.
It finally felt like the concerns we've been raising for years had been heard and acknowledged, and that we had committed as a partnership to work towards solutions that consider those concerns. And reading High Valley Transit's response in the newspaper, essentially to that discussion, was a complete 180.
Rubel said it's led him to question the nature of Park City's relationship with High Valley Transit.
Do they truly want to collaborate with us on a successful project? Or are we being told, like we have been for all those meetings previous to this last one, it's our way or the highway? No pun intended.
Park City Mayor Nan Worrell said the issues will be discussed Tuesday when city council members meet with the Utah Department of Transportation about the project, alongside representatives from Summit County and High Valley.
We're concerned about losing federal funding if we alter the scope of the project. And so I've asked that we go down with the county and talk with UDOT and hear directly from them how much wiggle room do we have to alter the project.
High Valley Transit has secured $66 million in grant funding for the bus rapid transit project, which is expected to cost around $90 million. Park City is expected to allocate some money for the project. However, it's unclear how much. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
The Wasatch County Council meets Wednesday at 4 o'clock, and on the phone with a preview of the meeting is Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybaugh. Good morning, Dustin.
Good morning, Leslie.
The council's still looking at Board of Equalization adjustments. So is this the final batch here?
These are items that have come up since we've closed the tax rolls for last year. Honestly, these things will probably continue to come up. They can be anything from greenbelt rollbacks to other property tax adjustments and kind of resolving issues from even 2 years ago. So there's a wide variety of issues that they have to tackle, and I think this is going to be kind of a run-of-the-mill item.
Okay. Also a discussion of the Wasatch County Deputy Sheriff Merit Commission. What's this?
So Wasatch County is in the process of appointing a third member to our Deputy Sheriff Merit Commission. This is a board that is required by state code for any county that has at least a 20,000 population or greater. And they fill a role basically in the hiring and promotion process at sheriff's office across the state. So because there have been some questions lately about the nature of the Merit Commission and what its responsibilities are, the council asked to have our attorney's office kind of review what the state code and county code responsibilities of the Merit Commission are. And then we can talk about the terms, because how the board works basically is that there are 6-year terms, but they're staggered so that every 2 years, one of those terms ends. So we'll be talking about that on Wednesday.
All right. Also, as we've reported, the county has hired a longtime third district court judge, Richard McKelvey, to look into the allegations of misconduct in the Wasatch County Sheriff's Office. Is this what retired judges do, lead investigations?
I mean, I think we actually feel like he's exceptionally well qualified for that. He also was a former prosecutor. And I think those are the types of qualifications. Typically retired law enforcement, retired attorneys are, I think, exceptionally well qualified for this type of work.
So why did you think it was important for Wasatch County to do its own investigation? As we've reported, Sheriff Jared Ribby also asking the Cache County Sheriff's Office to investigate. So do we really need two investigations?
Yeah, so the nature of the complaints are kind of wide-ranging and have been relatively vague. And so the Cache County investigation is looking primarily at accusations that are criminal in nature. And so their scope is limited to only those things. Whereas Wasatch County has an interest in a wider variety of potential issues, you know, if there are policy violations or other things like that that we need to examine and look at and provide an opportunity for employees to raise those issues. That's what this parallel investigation allows us to do, is have a broader scope on some of these things.
So how much has the county budgeted for the investigation?
I mean, this was obviously something we didn't plan for, so we didn't budget anything just yet. And I think it will kind of depend on the nature of the complaints that we get and how long this process will go on. But we expect it will cost several thousand dollars over the course of the next couple months.
All right. And you did meet with the judge last week to discuss how to proceed. So what happens now?
He's basically performing his role, where he's meeting with people, gathering information and being able to ask questions. We've largely given him a lot of latitude to work as he sees fit, so that way he can work with employees or former employees or members of the public who have concerns. And we've distributed his contact information to those who have requested it.
Yeah. Now, does everybody have to kind of go on the record, or can these insights be made anonymously?
I mean, I think if somebody wanted to provide something to us anonymously, we would take it. Ultimately, it's most helpful the more context we have. And particularly if somebody has a personal interaction that they wanted to share, it's helpful to be able to have a conversation with that person. But I think we'll take whatever we can get.
Okay. And is there a timeline on this?
I mean, right now we're still in kind of, I would say, the early stages of just gathering information. So we don't have a specific timeline. We're kind of going to take it where it goes. And so, if people have things that they wanted to provide to us, you can either send that to my office or reach out to my office for Judge McKelvey's contact information.
Okay. And will this report be presented to the public at some point?
I believe so.
Without redaction, or?
I mean, it kind of depends on the nature of what the findings are. Obviously, there's the potential for some of these problems to spill over into other things. For instance, if there were, you know, other legal matters or other legal ramifications, then it kind of depends on the nature of those complaints. Again, because they've been saying, it's hard to say exactly what that process is going to look like.
All right. Let's see. On Wednesday, the council also being asked to approve revisions to the library's policy manual, establishing public comment at library board meetings. So what precipitated these changes? I mean, have there been some problems with public comment?
So Wasatch County adopted a public comment policy earlier this year, and my understanding is that this largely adopts this is for the county council public meetings. This was in response largely to the issues that Midway had last year with some of Zoom bombing instances that they had. So what we've done is, since that time, we've worked on our own version of the policy to make sure that we can, you know, basically conduct the public's business in a way that isn't overly disruptive and allows us to be able to be transparent, to receive appropriate public comment, but not to disrupt the meeting from being able to proceed. And the libraries are really looking to do the same thing. I think that they, I'm not aware of any major issues that they've had, but really the best time to adopt these types of circumstances is before there are ever any problems. And I don't think they anticipate any, but that's kind of the whole idea of a prudent policy, is that you're preparing for what happens in these types of circumstances.
All right, let's see, there will also be a public hearing tomorrow at 6 p.m. on the Wildwood Reserve Development, basically to rename the subdivision and to remove a portion of the common area. Any issues you're aware of with the request?
No, I think this is just because a large project has developed as kind of a standalone piece. They're looking to build a clubhouse on what was previously a common area and then shift some open space to some other properties. So I don't think this will be an overly long or controversial item.
All right. And in other news, we've been reporting on the state legislature. House Bill 356 requires county council seats to be districted. Wasatch County Council, of course, has 7 members, 2 of whom are at-large members. So does anything change under this new bill for you? Will you have to district those 2 at-large members?
Yeah, our understanding is that the bill as currently approved legislature would require Wasatch County to adopt a 7 district model as opposed to our 5 districts and 2 at large.
All right, and the districts, I mean, you've got, what, 5 of them already, so it sounds like everything may need to be shifted to incorporate 2 more?
Yeah, there are a number of challenges that this bill presents. I think also because we feel that Wasatch County really wasn't considered when they adopted this bill. It was changed at the very last minute. It also requires that the council be randomly assigned to those 7 new districts, even if they don't live in that district and maybe weren't elected by people in that district, because unlike Summit County, we do have districts and there are people who only voted for some of those council members.
Hmm. So who gets to do that redistricting? Is that a Wasatch County Council decision?
So it's in the bill. My understanding is that basically Wasatch County participates with mayors of the cities or municipalities within Wasatch County or their designees. And that, again, as the bill currently is proposed, we would have to adopt a redistricted map by October of this year.
Okay. And again, that means shortened terms for some, or will folks who are just elected get to serve out their full term?
Yeah, so the bill allows anyone who's currently in office to remain in office, and that when their term expires is when the seat that they are randomly assigned is eligible for election. But again, because of the nature of this random assignment, it's possible they would be ineligible to run for the seat that they would occupy by the end of this year, because they may not live in that district.
So when does this have to be implemented by?
So I think it has to be implemented by the end of this year, so that when someone is registering for the county council election next year, they know exactly what districts they're registering for.
All right. House Bill 456 allows for up to a 1% increase in the transient room tax, most of that money going to the state of Utah, 0.75%. However, there is a new county option of a 0.25% TRT tax increase. And as an option, is Wasatch County planning to implement that?
We've had no discussions about implementing it. It's a little bit of a whirlwind at the end of the legislative session, just wrapping our arms around all the things that changed. So that one's not really been on our radar. There have been other changes to the TRT that we have been discussing, but I don't think there's been any interest or appetite yet expressed by any council members of changing the TRT levy.
All right. And then House Bill 256 allows cities and counties to use tech platforms to monitor and use data from short-term rental hosting platforms to kind of bring those owners out of the shadows and make sure that they're paying their fair share of taxes and make sure basically that the units are certified or safe. Does Wasatch County have a problem with short-term rentals not reporting?
I mean, I think anywhere there is short-term rentals is some form of non-compliance. I think without this type of monitoring, it's difficult to know or quantify exactly what those impacts are. I think our assessor's office is interested in making sure that these properties are properly classified and valued according to whether they have this kind of potential commercial value or if it's just a normal residence that doesn't have it.
All right. And any other legislation that you're a bit concerned about?
There are some other other larger changes, particularly to the development process that the state adopted. I believe it's 368, it's House Bill 368, that adopted some really significant changes to how infrastructure is bonded for and the timelines of those things. And so it's a really big change. I think it will affect every land use authority in the state of Utah. And so we're all kind of in this together to figure out how to best implement these new standards and kind of quantifying the impacts of them as well.
All right. Anything else, Dustin, you wanted to mention?
No, not this morning. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. That's Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybaugh. Well, Colorado lawmakers have now approved $34 million in financial incentives to entice the Sundance Film Festival to make its move to Boulder. KPCW's Parker Malatesta reports.
Colorado House Bill 1005 would provide Sundance with $34 million in tax credits over a 10-year period beginning in 2027. In the coming weeks, Sundance is expected to announce its future home after the 2026 festival in Park City. Along with Utah and Cincinnati, Ohio, Boulder, Colorado is one of Sundance's three finalists for the new 10-year contract. The Colorado House of Representatives approved the Sundance package in a 43-17 vote last week. It now heads to the state Senate for a vote. In February, the House Finance Committee passed the measure on a 7-6 vote. Colorado's proposed financial package stands above the public dollars Cincinnati and Utah have offered. Utah pitched a new model for the film festival with more screenings and events in Salt Lake City. Park City would serve as an ancillary location. Utah lawmakers approved a $3.5 million one-time allocation for Sundance in the recently passed state budget if the film festival chooses to stay. The Cincinnati City Council has approved $5 million for Sundance over 10 years. However, it's unclear how each state's bid compares in total offerings to lure the film festival because of the private nature of the bidding process. The nonprofit Sundance Institute has not released the information either. The Hollywood trade publication Deadline published a report last week indicating that some members of Sundance may be inclined to leave Utah due to a new state bill banning the use of pride flags on government property. Riverton Republican Senator Dan McKay has openly called for Sundance to leave, saying the film festival promotes pornography and other themes that deride the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
It's 23 degrees and snowing here in Old Town Park City. Again, those snow showers continuing through the day, looking for 2 to 4 inches possible with a high today of 30. Snow showers tapering off tonight, 15 is our overnight low. We should see some sunshine and a high of 36 tomorrow. Heber City's at 28 degrees, again, with a chance of some snow, less than an inch or so, a high of 37. 16 is the overnight low, mostly sunny, and 41 tomorrow. Well, the 10th annual Backcountry Bow Wow happens this Saturday, March 22nd, from 6 to 10 p.m. at the Marquee Park City on Main Street. In the studio with details, I have one of the organizers of the event, Andy Spock. He's with the Park City Professional Ski Patrol Association. Good morning, Andy.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I'm glad you could fill in for Mike. Sounds like he got called into avalanche duty.
Yeah, he was going to try and come in a little late to work today, but we don't really have that ability when we're out there mitigating all the avalanches.
Sure. All right. Well, let's talk about Saturday night. What's the evening all about?
So it's the Backcountry Bow Wow. We try and raise money, support local organizations. It's really trying to get out there, support the backcountry skiers, education. We try to teach them about avalanches and support their like rescue efforts out there.
So who are some of those organizations?
So we raise money for the Wasatch, the WBR, the Wasatch Backcountry Rescue. Also, the United Mountain Workers is our local union, so that's us, Solitude Ski Patrol, and the Park City Lift Maintenance. And then we also are, this year, giving some money to the Mountain Training Center. It's an online education for people. They can go there, learn about the backcountry, learn about traveling safely, and it's all of that's approved by the American Avalanche Association. It's one of those bigger bodies that kind of regulates everything.
Okay, so what happens Saturday night?
So we have it's a pretty big production. We have Pixie and the Party Grass Boys coming out to play, big dance, big party type of atmosphere. We're also going to have some like raffles and silent auctions for people, from people donating, from local businesses and different areas in the ski industry. We reach out to a bunch of people and get a bunch of prizes and gifts for everyone.
Great. Okay, so tickets are how much?
I believe tickets are $35 as of now if you were to like order them online, and I think day of tickets at the door will be a little bit more expensive.
Okay, and people with the tickets online, just search Backcountry Bow Wow and it'll...
Yeah, if you search Backcountry Bow Wow, it'll pop up. The ticket platforms Give Butter. We use them to help us do the silent auction and everything.
All right. How much money are you hoping to raise?
For the 10th annual, we were, you know, our big lofty goal was raising $100,000 for everyone. We'll see if we get there or not, but I know for the, I think the last like 4 years combined, we've raised over $60,000.
Okay. And it sounds like you're going to have some avalanche dogs on site.
Yep. So if you get there earlier before Pixie comes on, so Pixie's probably going to come about 7:30. So that 6 to 7:30 time slide, we usually have the dogs around. People can come meet the dogs, pet the dogs, talk to the handlers. And then once the music starts coming on, it's a little loud for them. So they tend to go back home.
Yeah. How many dogs does Park City Mountain have?
Park City has 13 dogs. We just got our 13th. She's a little like 8-week-old puppy named Goblin, and she's adorable. But yeah, 13 dogs, 10 of them are all trained up to level A, and we have 3 in training right now that are younger.
Okay, what does level A mean? That they have passed some kind of test?
Yeah, so the level A is they're allowed to go find people anywhere outside the resort that they're not used to. So they can go to the backcountry, they can go to another resort if they need it, or really operate anywhere.
So does the resort then pay for that training to have those dogs on site?
I believe they pay for like some of it. I mean, we go out there and we train the dogs twice a week. We play the game with them. We go hide in a hole. And as the dogs get older, the holes just get more complex and the terrain gets a little bit more and we hide ourselves better. And we just kind of teach them hide and seek.
And are the dogs patrollers pets? Or are they resort property?
Yeah. No, it used to be a long time ago. I heard that the resort would own the dogs and the dogs would stay at the resort. But now every dog is the owner's pet. It's better for the dog that they can stay with one owner and be more happy that way. But so the owner ends up buying the dog and then they come to work every day and play games all day and train all week.
Yeah. And dogs we know have just incredible, you know, sense of smell. Are there different breeds that make better avalanche dogs? Or
it used to be taught that like the Burmese mountain dogs, like those mountain dogs, were good, but I guess we have been moving towards like smaller, more agile dogs for moving around. But I don't know exactly like if there's better or less dogs, but all their senses are way better than ours, so I'm sure they can, whatever breed it was, would do fine.
Okay, because it seems like I see a lot of golden retrievers and maybe German shepherds.
Yeah. I know different resorts have a bunch of different mixes. At Park City, all of our Abbey dogs are labs.
Oh, okay. Let's see. You had mentioned that you've got kind of an opportunity drawings and some silent auctions happening. Is it too late for any local business to donate?
No. If we can get the items being donated by Saturday, it's the best. If it is going to come in a little later, we can try and like work around it. Maybe have like a screenshot or pictures of it for people to go on, and they can reach out to the business. But we've been running around collecting donations the last like 3 days. It seems like they all come in like within 5 days of the event.
Yeah, of course. All right. I mean, if somebody was interested, is there a place to go?
If they email backcountrybowwow@gmail.com, it's the best way for us to keep track of everything.
Okay. Maybe just talk a little bit about the numbers in terms of like, I mean, this season, kind of a late start, not a huge amount of snowfall. We haven't even hit that 100-inch mark, at least as a base. How busy have you guys been?
I mean, I don't know if like how much snow we have really affects how much we're out there like helping people. Veil really kind of hides those numbers and doesn't give it to us. I know there was studies done that it's anywhere from like 1.5 to 2.5 skiers per 1,000. And I don't know how true that is. I know, of course, on the busier days, we're more busy. On the less busy days, we're less busy. But it seems to be all types of snow conditions. People are out there finding weird places to call us at.
Yeah, right. Okay, so in addition to kind of helping people on the mountain, you're up early with avalanche control? Kind of what?
Yeah, so like today, I think we got like 5 to 7 inches of new snow up there. And depending on where the winds are coming, they'll call us in early to go do avalanche mitigation. And it's a big resort. I'm sure there's over 100 avalanche routes. And depending on the current conditions, they might send us on these ones or that ones. And we go up there and try to find the avalanches.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, we've heard in the backcountry, of course, just the problem of for these persistent weak layers, and not just one, but at one time, I think we had like four. Do you guys have to deal with that or not really, because you're always kind of blasting down to that layer?
I wouldn't say we're like blasting down to that layer. The best way to like combat that is skier compaction, and being in the resort, we have so many skiers to compact it. We don't really see that issue. But just outside our boundary in the backcountry where there's not that compaction, they do have that issue. And that's why like we have our ropes up and we don't want people to duck into the backcountry, even though it's side country, which I don't really like that term, because it's not as safe out there. It's not controlled. And it does have that issue.
Okay. And I know that the resort had closed the gate there at the top of 9990, but it sounds like people are just going out anyway.
Yep.
That's not your problem.
Yeah, I mean, It is and it isn't. So if someone were to duck out there and cause an avalanche, it very well could take us multiple hours to even respond to it. Or if they went out there and twisted their knee and they couldn't ski out, I mean, we got to call the sheriff, we got to get permission. It's a long process, and we also have to make sure that the avalanche risk out there is safe for us to even go, because, you know, scene safety is a priority.
Okay. Andy, anything else you want to tell us about the Bow Wow?
I mean, it's a super fun event. We come there, get to meet the dogs, get to have a good time, get to see fixing the Party Grass Boys. It's really all for the local community. We try and give back. This year, we had such great support from the community. This is one of the events we do every year to try and give back to everyone. And I know as of right now, we've received over $25,000 worth of donations and raffle prizes.
Awesome. Okay, Andy, thanks for coming in.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Andy's back again with the Park City Mountain Professional Ski Patrol Association, again with the Backcountry Bow Wow happening Saturday at the Park City Marquee on Main Street. Well, Kansas City Council members have placed a temporary ban on short-term rentals. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports Airbnbs already running in town, however, will be allowed to continue.
People operating short-term rentals within Kansas City limits are now required to register with the city by Friday, April 10th. Only registered properties will be allowed to continue renting on sites like Airbnb and Vrbo after the Kansas City Council passed a moratorium March 11th.
I hate using the word ban because it just seems so absolute. I'd rather do what we call a moratorium on any additional and continue with what we currently have.
Across the board, council members like Jessica Bateman say they wouldn't have approved the temporary ban on new listings if it didn't grandfather in existing STRs. A new state law allows Camas to use online listings as evidence if someone violates the moratorium, but the city needs, quote, additional information, such as neighbor complaints, to actually shut down someone's rental.
Enforcement is going to happen with the neighbors. You're going to get neighbors that complain, and that's how you're going to find out about it. I don't think we need to have our thumb on them all the time. Like I said, this is their business. They're going to make sure that these homes look nice and they're well kept.
That's Councilmember Monica Blazard speaking favorably about grandfathering in existing STRs as well. City engineer Scott Kettle estimates about a dozen short-term rentals were operating in Camas as of March. Some are in High Star Ranch, which allows them, through a development agreement with the city. The moratorium wouldn't affect High Star's agreement.
I've never received a neighbor complaint in almost 4 years I've worked in for Camas. However, I will say that I receive phone calls from potential buyers looking at properties for sale for the purpose of STRs. Although we currently don't have a formal ordinance in place banning STRs, under our allowed use table 15.30.020, we're able to say that any use that is not specifically designated as allowed is prohibited. And I do believe that this has deterred some buyers from purchasing property specifically as an STR.
A Summit County study found that STRs can increase housing prices and decrease the availability of long-term rentals in the market. But the de facto ban Kettle described wasn't enforceable until now. Violating the March 11th ordinance banning any future STRs will be met with a warning, and if the rental continues, a $500 fine. The short-term ban will be in place while the council debates long-term policy, according to city officials. Owners already running a short-term rental who want to continue renting have until April 10th to provide the city with evidence they've continuously been using their property as an STR. Those property owners will be required to get a business license with Camas City, and their customers must begin paying the transient room tax. That's a sales tax on hotel rooms and Airbnb rentals already imposed elsewhere in Summit County. Council members unanimously adopted the transient room tax after pausing any new short-term rentals March 11th. The moratorium doesn't affect bed and breakfasts, which are already licensed, but their customers will now have to pay the additional transient room tax too. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Well, the world's best alpine skiers are headed to Park City this week to train at the Utah Olympic Park before making their way to the FIS Ski World Cup Finals in Sun Valley. On the phone with details, I have Park City Ski and Snowboard Alpine Director Tommy Eckfeldt. Good morning, Tommy.
Morning, Leslie. How are you doing?
Doing great, thanks. So any idea how many athletes will be training at the UOP from the World Cup circuit?
We've got a handful of World Cup teams, namely currently right here right now is Norway, men's World Cup speed. Their events start with their first training runs this week. So they're here for a couple days, a tune-up, and then they're out. Obviously, with the inclement weather today, I think it's put a little bit of a hamper on their plans with the high winds here at West Peak. But they've said they've had really good training at the Spencer F. Eccles Olympic Mountain Center here at the Utah Olympic Park.
Okay. So
also, we've got the Swiss and the French are coming in, their tech teams. Are coming in here in a couple days. They come in just after the speed leaves because their events start a little bit later up at Sun Valley.
Okay, so do we have any Team USA members coming in as well?
We had heard that, yeah, there was. Lindsey Vonn is here right now. We saw there was a sighting of her yesterday, the day before, training some Super G with special operations coach for Red Bull, Patrick Rimmel, who was a former U.S. ski team coach and director. So there have been sightings of her, which has been cool to see. But yeah, right now I think there are plans for our national teams to come in after and train a little bit after they come back from World Cup Finals.
So I'm surprised that you are running any kind of speed events there. It's pretty darn steep. Or where do the GS and downhill courses get set?
Yeah, it's not so much downhill, but the Super G event does provide quite a bit of glide and longer turn shapes. Obviously, it's not going to compare to the length that we're going to see at Sun Valley for the World Cup Finals downhill track. But the Trail Olympic hopeful here is no slouch. It's definitely pretty steep for those that have skied it. It's really in your face most of the way down. So Dominic Paris from Italy was up here the other day with that Red Bull team, and he commented saying that, yeah, it was pretty legit trail. And it just kind of keeps breaking over, and it just means you just got to be on your game the whole way down. Whereas, you know, our CB's trail, which has historically been a trail favorite for us at Park City Mountain, it gets flatter at the bottom, so it kind of gives the athletes a little bit of reprieve as they come down, and it's more challenging up top. Whereas this trail is flatter up top, and then it continues to get harder all the way down as your legs continue to get more and more tired. So these World Cup athletes are even seeing the challenges of our trail and our home training venue, which is pretty cool to hear them even complaining as well.
Yeah, okay. So you're going to set out, again, you'll have Super G for the speed guys and then GS and slalom on that steep run there, huh?
Yeah, the UOP Mountain Ops crew did a great job of helping us prepare the surface early on in the season. With the limited amounts of snow we've had, if you can believe it, we actually have been scraping down to the ice with our snow caps, kind of in a reverse, completely counterintuitive procedure that normal mountain operations would have, but we're trying to maintain that surface. Think of, you know, driving on a dirt road that's really bumpy versus a smooth paved road. So that's what we're trying to give the athletes here. We're trying to give all of our groups, our local training efforts, as well as the World Cup teams, the best surface that we can actually get here at the Olympic Park. And the team's done a great job. They've really been working with our coaches to kind of come up with the hard surface. And now we're seeing the fruits of our labor because as we're coming through these small storm cycles where they're dumping 4 to 6 inches, it would create potentially a new layer that's soft and, you know, maybe unmanageable, unsafe. But we've been able to train right through it. outside of the high winds, you know, that we have no control over shutting down the lifts, we've been able to have pretty solid, consistent training on Olympic Hopeful, and I would submit our smaller hills, the intermediate hills, for a majority of our sessions for local and World Cup teams. So it's been great.
Yeah. So how does something like this work? I mean, I guess basically the facility is rented to these national teams?
Yeah. I mean, the UOP is one of a very few areas locally that rents out actual lane space. And if you think about it, we're taking a trail and we're slicing it up by width of a cat. So, you know, a lane may be, we say, two cat widths wide or about 50 feet. And that provides enough space for everyone, for, you know, three lanes to get set. And then we shadow or mirror the courses to ensure that athletes are moving in the same direction. We alternate lanes and athletes on a regular basis so that they can actually provide the same snow surface for multiple teams where they all don't have to run on the same course. So it's an interesting model. It happens around the world for a lot of our snow surfaces, summertime glacier skiing, and even what we see now, you know, in winter. So we're using these lanes on a regular basis, but it's pretty normal from our alpine racing community to see this kind of rental model of snow and lane space.
All right. So can the public just come up and watch?
Yeah, I'm sure, you know, there is areas where at the bottom of Olympic Hopeful where we have a parking lot there, and there's 55 spots there. We can also park in the main lot, but you can walk over to the bottom of the lift. There is a spectator viewing area at the bottom by the tent. They can come in and be able to look up the hill and see the last remaining gates. But a lot of those athletes are skiing down, and you'll see them in our, you know, in their foreign suits and uniforms that are pretty easy to pick out. But I would say our local teams are our fifth age athletes, our U16s, and, you know, of Park City Ski and Snowboard and Royal Marks Ski Academy, University of Utah, we're all training side by side with them too, which is pretty cool.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Let's see. Also, I noticed on the website that it sounds like U.S. Park City Ski and Snowboard has had some support from former World Cup skiers like Ted Ligety and Bodie Miller. It sounds like what they're helping to raise money by skiing with supporters.
Yeah, we got Heidi Volker, also a community member here, great supporter of our club, former national team racer. She's been a huge supporter for us. We had her son in our program for the last number of years, but she was able to string together what we're calling an all-star ski experience, and it really allowed people to come in and donate funds to the club and have a really cool one-on-one experience with former Olympians like Ted and Bodie. We can't say enough thanks and give them enough gratitude for stepping up, donating their time to the club, and really being involved. I mean, it's great. You know, Ted, obviously, as a former athlete of our club and a former alum of Park City Ski Team, it's really cool. We see him out here now regularly, you know, working with his kids, working with our kids, with our youth development programs, and our GROM 6-year-old program, and then our skills and drills 7 and 8, because we have his kids in there. But Bodie is new to our community. Really cool to see him kind of stepping up and getting out there. He's got a whole team of kids. So I'm hoping that we'll be able to see him and some of our and his kids in our programs soon. But the event was really cool. They did a full day of skiing. Bodie and Ted actually skied with just two people, and they were able to do video analysis of their free skiing with these guys. So they got some one-on-one coaching with these former Olympians. They were kind of able to see inside their minds and see kind of how they were thinking about skiing and just the movement of skiing in general. So really, really cool experience.
Yeah, I bet. All right. In our last few minutes, you had some updates on last weekend's IMD championships. These are the Intermountain Championships. What ages are we talking about?
So the IMD championships was held at Snow Basin last weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. That's U10s and U12s. Really cool thing here is it's really primarily made for U12 athletes. We had 35 athletes in total attend this qualify for this championship event. Six of those were U10, so they actually have to ski and qualify as a U12. So they actually got to do well enough to qualify up as a U12 athlete.
a number of really good podiums there. We saw several first place finishes. So really proud of all those athletes, both U10 and U12. But what's amazing is that we have had, currently we've got about 100 athletes competing in championship races across the country right now, from NORAM finals at Burke to our Western Region Junior Championships for our fifth races. We had 15 athletes out there at Mission Ridge. Currently going on are both our U16 regionals and our tri-divisional championships. Another huge group of athletes at both tri-Ds and U16s, and those are just starting up right now as we speak. And we've also got IMD finals coming up at Sundance this weekend for all the U10s and U12s that didn't make IMD championships, as well as our U14 regionals at Mammoth coming up next week. So big, busy time for us. We've got athletes spread out everywhere, but we're seeing results. I think we're seeing, you know, kind of the fruits of our labor here. Everyone's been skiing well and getting some solid scores in. So we still have a lot of the season left to go, and we're hopeful that we'll get some more results.
Okay, and you got through, I think, what was it, like 55 races that you had scheduled for February and March or something crazy?
Yeah, we had 32 races scheduled in 30 days. We lost two, so we did 30 races in 30 days. It was a huge effort by our team. Can't thank our coaching staff enough for coming out and helping. And both Jason Lance, our junior programs director, and myself were the chief of race for all of those races. So it was a massive effort and a really condensed schedule, but we were able to maintain the venues. Both of our partners that we held races at, Park City Mountain Resort and the Utah Olympic Park, did a great job of, you know, getting the services ready, getting the venues, and, you know, helping us get the venues maintained throughout that entire month time, especially in February. It can be a really snowy and unpredictable month. So we got it done, and boy, it's a huge weight off our shoulders to see all those athletes have success and racing at home on home snow is pretty cool.
Hey, and somebody was asking, these all-star ski experiences, was that just kind of a one and done, or are they available if somebody would be interested?
Yeah, you know, it was Heidi's kind of pet project this, you know, early on this fall. We ran it as a pilot this year. We're really hoping to bring it back in subsequent years. I think with the sounds like, you know, the success that it had with the small group, we're going to bring it back next year for sure. So definitely look, keep your eyes peeled on our website. It's parkcityss.org. And we should have more information now coming out in the fall or early winter of next season.
Okay, Tom, anything else you want to mention?
I think that's great, Leslie. Thanks for supporting us, and thanks for giving us time to share our results.
You're welcome. That's Tommy Eckfeldt, again, Alpine Director for Park City Ski and Snowboard. Well, defense attorneys for the Camas mother of three, accused of fatally poisoning her husband, says she can't get a fair trial here in Summit County. A month and a half before Corey Richens is scheduled to stand trial for her husband Eric Richens' alleged murder, her attorneys have asked a judge to move the proceedings to Salt Lake County. If Third District Judge Richard Morozik rules in their favor, no one from Summit County will serve on the jury, only Salt Lake County residents will. Richens is charged with attempted murder, aggravated murder, and financial crimes in connection with her husband's 2022 fentanyl overdose. She has pleaded not guilty to every count and is scheduled for a four-week trial beginning the last week of April. Her attorneys say she's more likely to get a fair trial in Salt Lake County with 2.5 times more people than Summit County and a larger potential pool of jurors. In a motion filed Monday, attorneys cited the more than 100 local media stories and the prominence of the victim's family in the community. They surveyed residents of Salt Lake and Summit counties. A quarter of Summit County residents surveyed had a direct or indirect connection to the Richens family, according to the defense. By comparison, Corey Richens is a Summit County transplant from a non-LDS low-income family, which her attorneys say may bias a local jury against her. Her attorneys further argue local and national media reports have contained inaccurate details, and based on their survey, Summit County residents may have consumed inflammatory, misleading, and false information about the case.